Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of May. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Jim Clarkin. He's Chief Executive of Oxfam Ireland. Irish workers took a 3.9% pay cut last year as wages lagged behind inflation. We'll speak to Siobhan Grogan, Kildare Na Gaeilge, because they have begun to put together a 7-year language plan for County Kildare, and there's a series of language planning workshops taking place around the county over the next few weeks. We'll speak to Professor Luke Clancy. He's Director General of Tobacco Free Research Institute Ireland and Adjunct Professor at the Technological University in Dublin. The government is to ban the sale of vapes to children by mid-July of this year. And then we'll speak to Kevin Donoghue. He's the Chair of 4-Day Week Ireland, a second pilot programme for a 4-Day Week in Ireland has been launched, and companies across Kildare are being encouraged to sign up for the 6-month trial. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can call in 045 898 999. Athy's Kate Dooley is on the phone. If you want to email me, it's studio@kfmradio.com, or of course, you can send me a text.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, Irish workers took a 3.9% pay cut last year because wages lagged behind inflation. That's according to new research from Oxfam, which was released to mark International Workers' Day. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Jim Clarkin. He's Chief Executive of Oxfam Ireland. Good afternoon, Jim.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe.
Really not good news for workers, Jim, is it?
No, it's not. We know that inflation has, was kind of out of control over the past year. That workers' wages are just not coming anywhere near meeting it. But it's important to remember that this is on top of years of wage stagnation. So pay has not been increasing for most people over quite the longest time. This has resulted in a real cost of living crisis for many people, and people are struggling to keep up, working longer for less, and struggling to keep up with the cost of living. I mean, during the pandemic, even prices crept up gradually. They haven't come back, and the wider cost of living continues to increase. And in parallel to this, we see that the salaries of CEOs in the large corporations, as well as the returns on dividends, on shares, are growing at quite a dramatic rate. So basically, that's saying is that ordinary people and poor people are just hanging in there, and then you have all these others that are generating huge additional wealth. So there's a continuing gap growing between ordinary people and the very wealthy.
Okay, so CEOs and then dividends of companies are up, but yet our wages are stagnant. The charity found that this equates to a loss of, say, €2,107 in real wages, which before I came on air, Jim, I just kind of tossed it up there. So, like, say for someone who was on like around €32,000 or €33,000 a year, that's like a full month's wages.
Yeah, I think it was based on the average industrial wage, which is a bit higher than that, but it was just to give a sense that it is quite substantial, and people will feel it. I mean, people are feeling it when they go to do their shopping, and when they fill the trolley. It's a heck of a lot more than what it was a year ago. Or you're getting it costs you more, or you're getting less, depending on what you can do. So it has been going on, and it's been going on for a number of years, and then we're seeing this consistently across the globe, because this was a global study as we do, do we say that in 50 countries, a billion workers took an average pay cut of $685, so $746 billion in wages across the world. So it is a trend. We're seeing it in Ireland. We're seeing it elsewhere too. We need to look at how do we address these kind of things when the cost of, obviously, housing is the biggest, single biggest issue here in Ireland. But food, education, healthcare, all those other things that are essential, how people can access them, And then the other thing that we see is that unpaid care work, which is, you know, the vast majority, which is carried out by women, continues to be a huge issue and growing and not recognised appropriately. So we have all these things that are kind of, you know, putting additional pressure on people. And there isn't the upside to the increases that they might expect.
So, Jim, how do we address it then? I know, apart from the obvious of, like, people need to get an increase in wages, but how do we go about doing that overall across the board?
Well, what we're saying is that one of the key issues that we want to look at, because we, as Oxfam, we're looking at inequality in the broader sense, and we want to just recognise as well that for the first time in 25 years, inequality is growing. So extreme wealth and extreme poverty are growing at the same time, which hasn't happened before. In the past, one might increase and one might improve a little bit, but that's not happening. It's actually getting worse. So that big gap is growing. So what we're saying there is we want to have a focus on those who are very wealthy, because we do think this now is the time to have a serious discussion about how we tax extreme wealth, both in Ireland and across the globe, because that's it's just not being done. And it's, you know, it's an opportunity for those who are extremely wealthy to better participate. It is only fair and right when you think that it is the work of normal people that help to create that wealth. And it is the taxes of normal people that help to pay for all the infrastructure and all the other things that those companies and those individuals need in order to have a working society that provides that opportunity for those businesses to succeed, if you know what I mean. So so it's only right and proper that those who are at that extreme level of wealth should be taxed appropriately to contribute more.
So a wealth tax then, Jim, where would you see, like, at what level, you know, are you talking about someone earning 150,000 a year, or, like, you know, where would you put the line?
Well, we've looked at wealth tax, you know, as there's a taxation commission which has, you know, been convened in Ireland, and we made some contributions to it, and we're still waiting to see what the wealth tax aspect of that. So within that, we looked at actual wealth rather than income. So we said, okay, even at quite a high, low bar, if you know what I mean, even at a bar of about 4.5 million, you know, and there are a lot of people in Ireland, believe it, who have that much wealth.
Right.
Between that and 50 million, if you were to stagger wealth, stagger taxes between just 2% and 5%, very, very modest taxes, you could generate as much as 8 billion euros. So for that level, and then there's a whole other question about very high earnings and so on, that you know, and we don't have the answers. We don't pretend to have all the answers, to be honest, Cuiva. But we think it's important that there's a conversation and a dialogue happening about it, and that we start to seriously look at how this can be done and get all the key players involved in this discussion, because there's an important part of our economy that's not being taxed appropriately here, and the money would make a massive difference.
Absolutely. I know, Jim, you said that this was looked at overall worldwide wages, but in comparison to other countries, how does Ireland fare out in terms of the taxing here, or the severe changes that you're saying have happened worldwide? Are we better or worse?
Well, interestingly, just on the main stat that this particular, because it was specifically looking at workers because of the day that was in it, but worldwide workers took a 3% pay cut, as we've described it. In Ireland, it's 3.9, almost 4%. So we're ahead of, you know, it's been more dramatic here than it has been on average across the world.
Okay.
So that's something worth considering. But certainly that wider question of taxation on wealth is one that we need to be having.
Okay. Jim Clarkin, Chief Executive of Oxfam Ireland, with that news there that Irish workers took a 3.9% pay cut last year as wages lagged behind inflation. Thanks very much to Jim for his time. I'd love to know, if you are working, have you got a rise in the last couple of months or in the last few years? I know some people have, some places haven't. 0833 97 97 97. Or what would you like done about wealth taxes in Ireland?
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, Kildare La Guelga has begun to put together a 7-year language plan for County Kildare, and they also will have a series of language planning workshops taking place across the county over the next few weeks. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Siobhan Grogan of Kildare La Guelga. Good afternoon, Siobhan.
How are you, Caoimhe? Thanks very much for inviting me on.
Delighted to have you, Siobhan. Well, look, there's probably people like me who would have a panic attack when I saw the first side of the press release that was sent out, all in Irish, Siobhan. I was thinking, I know, how am I going to read this on air? But if you do feel like that, it's good news, because there's going to be lots of new things coming on stream to support people in regards to Irish.
Yeah, and Caoimhe, I can totally identify with that feeling. That's exactly where I was. And I decided that as an adult that I was going to come back to Irish. I wanted to engage, and I was lucky enough, living in Naas, we decided to raise our children through Irish. But actually what really supported that decision was that there was a breakfast at Osgoelge every Saturday morning in Aroma Mocha, and there was a group, so there was a pub in the Gaeilge, Solon had started that brick foster, and everybody and anybody, all levels of Irish were welcome. And from that has grown a movement, in the area, where more and more people are getting to know each other and more people are getting over that fear. And I can absolutely 100% identify with that fear. But there is a big mixture of people in Pobl na Gaeilge now, not only in the Naas Salans area, but across the county. So you have fluent speakers, you have people who are well into their learning journey, and then you have other people who are starting out. So there is room for everybody. There's room for, including yourself, Caoimhe.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that, Siobhan. Because as far as I understand, the Naas Salans area, there's been things put in place now to eventually move that to a Gaeltacht area.
Yeah, so there's we're on the road to, now it's a long road, but okay, we're well on the road to being recognised nationally as a Lean Ra Gaeilge, which is an Irish language network,
right,
outside
okay
of a Gaeltacht. So we wouldn't have Gaeltacht status, because we're not, I suppose we're kind of new into the language recognition. But it's a Lean Ra Gaeilge, and it will be, to be honest, it will be a massive achievement for the area. And it all falls under our language plan. It was one of our aims, was to be recognised as a Lean Ra Gaeilge. And we're on the road, but as you know, the wheels of authority move very, very slowly. Mm. So we're at the mercy of the Department of the Gaeltacht. But as we understand it, people are very supportive. And we have, like, one of our primary aim, actually, from the, we're coming to the end of the 5-year plan that we had, which we launched in 2019. And our primary aim, our very first one that's mentioned in the plan, was that before the end of that language plan, that there would be 2 full-time employees working in the county, Éireann na Gaeilge. And we've achieved that. So Kildare na Gaeilge set up as a company so that we could, that we had the correct structure to be able to maybe be a little bit more ambitious than we were as a community group with Sutton Solon, who are a fantastic community group. But it allowed us the structure to employ 2 people. So we have 2 full-time employees working at Éireann na Gaeilge. One, who's also Caoimhe, actually, is more focused on the Naas Salans area, which will be the Lean Ra, and Sarah has a wider brief, throughout the county. So that was one of the successes of the last language plan. Whereas without the plan, I'm not sure that we would have had such a definite focus, and I'm not sure whether we would have been as clear in our vision for what we wanted. Mm. So the plan, the planning process gave us a structure. It kind of cleaned up our vision and cleaned up our focus, so we knew what we wanted to aim for. And okay, that's what, and because we're coming near to the end of it, we're launching a new one. It'll be next year, but we're starting the process now. And we want to give as many people an opportunity to have a voice and to have an input, regardless of their level of Irish. Because as I said, it is for everybody. It's like Gaeltacht and Gaeilge. Everybody owns this language. Mm. So, as you mentioned, we're running a series of workshops in Naas, Athy, Kildare Town, Leixlip and Maynooth, to give people an opportunity.
We'll come back to the workshops there in a moment. Yep. But in regards to then the new 7-year language plan for County Kildare, are you saying that you're looking for people to get involved, give their ideas, what they think it should look like, Siobhan?
That's exactly it, because we're not a government organisation. We're simply a group of people who have a shared vision. That's what we are. It's what we started out with as with Sultan Sullivan, and when we grew and started the non-profit company Kildare La Gaeilge, we still have that exact same vision, where we're just a group of people who want to put together a plan to help all of the people of County Kildare. So we're basically writing, I know it sounds a little bit corny, but this is a plan for the people by the people. And that's exactly it. So no matter who you are, no matter, like, if you are somebody who would like to engage but you're a bit afraid, well, maybe you have an idea. Well, what would help you get on that road? Mm-hmm. Well, share that idea and maybe it can happen. Do you know the way sometimes people have really good ideas, or they wish that something would happen, but they actually don't tell anybody. They, you know, and then it doesn't happen. Whereas sometimes if you share that idea, somebody else will go, well, actually, I have a really good way of doing that, or I know somebody who can help make that happen. So that's what we want. We want an opportunity for people to share those ideas, and let's make it happen.
Absolutely. And like everything else in life, communication is key there, isn't it? And we can, I suppose, work together better if everyone pulls in. Siobhan, you said that you used to be like me, where when I saw a full page of Irish in front of me there, I had a bit of a panic attack. But can you talk me through your own journey? Like, did you not have a great level of Irish and you went back and you learnt Irish from scratch?
Well, I can't say from scratch, because I did Irish in school.
Okay.
So
like
I
most
did Irish
people.
In school, but
yeah.
Like most, exactly. Like, I'd say my own experience in school would be very similar. I wasn't great at Irish. Mm. I didn't have a huge interest, I have to say. I didn't appreciate, I didn't understand, I suppose. I didn't have a great understanding of the value of the language as, you know, part of our culture, part of our heritage, part of our history. I wasn't interested in any of that. Didn't recognise it for what it was until, the thing that probably kick-started me was at the end of fifth year, our Irish teacher at the time was encouraging us to go to Gaeltacht. And I went for 3 weeks to Coláiste Comish and was terrified, absolutely terrified. Didn't speak for the first few days because it was very strict. And if you spoke full sentence of English, you were sent home. I'd have been murdered. But I had to get over it. So I was in a situation where it was full immersion, had to get over it, and I did. Now, I can't say I came back and was absolutely perfect, but I suddenly realised I actually had an awful lot more Irish than I thought I had. And because I was forced into speaking it, if you like, I had to dig deep and find it in a really fun way. There wasn't the pressure of an exam in the Gaeltacht or any of that. And it just made me realise, hang on a second, I actually have a lot more. Now, it was later as an adult that I went to a few classes in Conor na Gaeilge and, you know, sort of had enjoyed it as an adult, which is a very different experience from school. There's no exams, there's no pressure, there's other learners, you're kind of muddling along together and nobody's judging. I was afraid that I would be judged. That never happened. I never experienced the judgment that you see is people talk about. I never experienced that. Nothing but a supportive, positive environment. I have to say, and I genuinely mean this, it's the best thing I ever did. And then that myself and my husband, as learners, as early learners, we decided to raise our kids through Irish.
It and did your husband decision. Go back too,
He
Sean.
Was very much like me, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, very much. So we went back and then I suppose it was easier because we shared the journey together. But absolutely the best decision we ever made. And we have made fantastic friends in around the area. People, like I grew up in Naas, and like we've made friends that people I would never have met only for this journey. It has been nothing but a positive experience. And the fact that there is room for everybody, regardless of where you are in the journey, and that people want to hear, you know, your opinions and what you think and how we can improve and what kind of activities we can put together and how can we help somebody who's maybe just moved to the country engage with the language, you know, kind of classes that are tailored to them. There's just so much potential for everybody to get involved.
It really does sound great. And like you said, you had your husband like a study buddy, and maybe that's kind of the key, that, you know, to go maybe with a friend or something, that you kind of are in it together. But there are these sessions taking place, Siobhan, and they can be found, more details on www.daralaguilga.ie. But if I just quickly run through it, on the 4th of May in the Naas Town House Hotel, of course on Limerick Road there in Naas, from 7 till 9:15. There's one in Athy on the 10th of May in the Athy Arts Centre, Woodstock Street in Athy. That's also from the same time, from 7 until 9:15. Then in Newbridge on the 11th of May, no time here for that one, or the 16th of May in Maynooth, and then in Leixlip to be confirmed. But
the Leixlip date has been confirmed for the 15th of May. We
15th.
Actually just got that confirmed, yeah. There are a few venues still to be decided, but all of the information as it comes into us, because it's local groups that are getting involved now, which is a huge step forward. When we wrote the first language plan, essentially Sultan of Solon consulted with lots of groups, but we were the only Irish language group that was involved in the language plan. Since that first language plan was launched at the beginning of 2019, every single, I was going to say counterpart, it's like municipal district in the county has its own language, Irish language group now, which is a massive achievement for the county. So those local groups are integral to writing the new language plan. So we're waiting for a little bit of information from them, but it'll all be up on kildarelagailge.ie.
Okay, Siobhan Grogan, an inspiration there to anyone who wants to pick up the Irish. And Siobhan, we actually have a new recruit in here today on work experience for the summer, Kate Dooley, and she's actually from Athy, but she went to the Gaelscoil in Carlo. So maybe myself and Kate can have a few cúpla focal later on, and she'll bring me on the right road to Irish.
Absolutely
know.
Make use of the fact that you have a fluent speaker near you.
Absolutely. I will.
Because that is the key. If you have somebody who's a little bit better than you, that person will help you to improve. So, yeah, enjoy the cúpla focal with Kate.
I will indeed. Thanks very much, Siobhan. That is Siobhan Grogan from Kildare Na Gaeilge. The Department of Health's bill soon will ban the sale of vapes to children and advertising near schools. So I'm joined now on the line by Professor Luke Clancy. He's Director General of Tobacco Free Research Institute Ireland and Adjunct Professor at the Technological University in Dublin. Good afternoon, Professor Clancy.
Good afternoon.
This is great news, really, I suppose, for particularly people under the age of 18, because they have been hit the hardest in terms of the loose marketing of these.
Well, that's true. It hasn't happened yet, of course. And the big news today was that Australia has banned them outright, except under prescription. But we're told, and this is the second time or third time there's been an announcement that they're going to introduce some restrictions in Ireland. Mm. Now, we've been recording the use of e-cigarettes by young people since 2014, and we've just seen it grow and grow. At that time, only 4% of the children who used them had never used cigarettes, and now 70% of them have never used a cigarette.
Mm.
And unfortunately, we found that if you do smoke or use e-cigarettes at, say, 16, which is the age we measured, you're twice as likely to smoke cigarettes. And that's our main worry. You know, they are bad in themselves, they're addictive, and we know they do damage to children's brains. But apart from that, we're worried because they lead to smoking as well in twice as many as would normally smoke. Of course, what we hear is that they'll be banned for under 18s. Mm. There's no great rationale for that, because what we do know is that young people's brains are not fully developed, and they say about age 25, and prior to that, they're more susceptible to the effect of nicotine on breaking down connections or synapses. And so we know it damages brain at that stage, apart from the fact that they're addictive and that they lead to cigarettes, there's actually brain damage. So why they picked 18 is hard to know. And the other side of it now that's emerging as very important is that these are polluting the countryside and the country and the world because of the plastic. And also they have electronic devices, as we know. But I think the young people aren't quite aware of that, and they don't think of them as electronic devices, and they're disposed of irregularly. You know, they should be disposed of the same as other electronic devices. And even then, you know, we've heard Oisín Smith, the minister, complaining that they're using valuable resource. You know, the batteries have lithium in them. Mm. And here we are throwing it away and polluting the countryside as well and addicting our children and leading to smoking. So there's nothing good about them. Now, they have been shown in some trials to be possible to give up cigarettes with them. They're probably no better than the ordinary nicotine replacement in that regard, but they have been shown that they can be used like that. But since we have plenty of those already, we don't really need this. So there can be no need for them, and especially for young people. They, you know, when we ask them, why did you use these? Was it to stop smoking? Less than 3% of them use them to stop smoking. So that's a nonsense. So it is recreational, and that's why the Australians are saying this is a recreational drug that's addicting our children. Let's stop it.
Yeah, and you talk about there, and it's only on prescription in Australia, but as I understand here, I don't think the HSE advocates us using vapes for to get off cigarettes. That's as far as I know now. Do you think, would you like to see something similar come in here where they were banned outright?
Well, I would, but it's, you know, I've been asking something to be done about them for 7 years, so they're not ready to ban them, but if at least if they even did what they said they're doing, which is just put an age limit. But why this age limit? I'd like the age limit higher. And I'd certainly like to see flavours banned.
Mm.
You know, here are these flavours that attract strawberry, etc., that attract children, and colours that attract them. And then we don't know when you inhale these flavours into your lungs. As a respiratory physician, I can't tell you what it will do. We do know that strawberries, etc., they're made to be eaten, not to be inhaled into your lungs. And when you do, it's quite a different thing from ingesting them. So that these chemicals go into your lungs and damage the lung. There's no doubt about it. Mm. Now, they may not cause terrible damage initially, but they are harmful. And worse still, they are attractive to children. So they should ban the flavours. And they should do something about disposable electronic cigarettes. There are some cigarettes, on e-cigarettes on the market that are single use. Can you imagine the waste that's in that?
Mm.
And we have no plan for that. And we do need a plan for that. And we do have to ask, what do we need these for?
Mm.
You know, if it really is to help people stop smoking, well, then the logical thing would be the Australian thing. But that goes a bit against the use of NRT, which people have been trying to liberalise to make more readily available rather than restrictions. So going to your chemist for a prescription of e-cigarettes, the advantage of it would be that we'd be able to stand over the quality. We know that if it was regulated as a medicine, it would have to have very strict criteria. Now, there are criteria at the moment, and there are supposed to be limits of nicotine and of other substances. But, for instance, the environmental health officers have found that the amount of nicotine in some that they tested were twice what was written on the pack. So we don't know. So if they were restricted as medicines, it would mean we'd know the quality of them. But it may not be worth it. What do we need them for?
Mm. How do we compare, do you know, Professor Clancy, in comparison to other countries in terms of vaping and in terms of how we sell these vapes? I know, obviously, at the moment, they can be bought by children under the age of 18. Is it similar in other jurisdictions?
No. In most of Europe, they've already taken age limits into account and done them. And many countries in the world have banned them outright. You can't have e-cigarettes at all. Something like 40 countries in the world have banned them completely, but and big countries. But the in Europe, where we're part of the same system, most countries have already banned the age, and a lot of them are trying to prevent flavours. And they are also increasingly aware of the pollution problem, which, you know, this is supposed to be important to young people. And here's something that they're doing, that they're causing trouble with. Mm. So there can be little help for that. Now, the only country that we're not well aligned with would be the UK. And I think that's significant. I think a lot of our leaders have been influenced by the attitude to e-cigarettes in the UK. And they're listening to them and not to us. And, you know, we repeatedly survey this and show that they're causing trouble and show that they're addicting our children. But yet they'll say, oh, Public Health England are saying they're OK, they're good for stopping smoking, even though our children are not smoking. And indeed, we found that, you know, we've been measuring smoking as well for 25 years. And every time we measured it, the level of smoking had declined until the last time in 2019. For the first time in 25 years, we saw an elevation in the smoking, which paralleled the increase in use of e-cigarettes. And then we did the test to see, oh, and you're twice as likely to smoke if you use e-cigarettes. So for every reason, they should be not allowed for children.
Okay.
And they should be very much restricted for cessation, because even in the trials where they did cessation, you know, against NRT and so on, some of them have shown advantage. But we do have this problem that they're not regulated. We don't know what's in them. And that's why the HSE has not been forthcoming in saying you should use these. They do allow, if people are on them, they let them. But they don't want to suggest them or prescribe them, because we don't really know what's in most of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. We could talk all day. That is Professor Luke Clancy, Director General of Tobacco Free Research Institute in Ireland and adjunct professor at the Technological University in Dublin. Thanks very much to Professor Clancy there. Now, a second pilot programme for a four-day week in Ireland has been launched, which companies are being encouraged to sign up for the six-month trial. The first reduced work time trial here returned a 100% success rate with employers. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Kevin Donoghue. He's chair of 4 Day Week Ireland. Good afternoon, Kevin.
Good afternoon, Cuva.
Kevin, it's great news, and I think something that many people would absolutely love to have implemented in their own lives.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think we had phenomenal success in relation to the first pilot. I think the research that we published off the back of that pilot and the experience with that pilot has encouraged a lot of people in terms of the, you know, potential impact for their businesses. And the reason that we have launched the second pilot is to create a space for employers for companies who think that the four-day week might work for them to get involved in that conversation. And I suppose to spur the conversation on a little further, we're holding two information sessions that are free of charge on May 4th and May 11th at 1 o'clock. And you can sign up or register for them at fourdayweek.com/events. That's the number 4, fourdayweek.com/events. So you can come in, it's an online event, it's a webinar, you can ask questions about how the four-day week might work for you, what supports and so on are on offer. There's a two-month pre-trial phase, which gives people the opportunity to ask those questions, iron out those issues. But the core message here is that companies that sign up to four-day week trials keep the four-day week after the trial, because it's better for them and it's better for their workers.
Well, yeah, the 12 Irish companies that participated, none returned to the five-day work week. So explain that to us then, Kevin, because, you know, we'll be getting messages in here now. Oh, it's the snowflake generation. People don't want to work, all these kind of things. But you're saying actually you're finding that people are able to do the same work in a shorter time frame and they're happier for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, these are self-reported metrics, I suppose, from the companies that are involved. We had, as you mentioned, we've had the Irish trial and the research that was published around that. There was a more significant trial in terms of the number of people involved. It was in the UK, which was published in February, which essentially copper-fastened the idea that both workers and employers benefit as a result of the implementation of the four-day week. There is, I think, and it's high time it was challenged, there's this view that the level of productivity you have at work is directly connected to the number of hours that you spend at work. That's not true. It's not the case. And once you examine that premise, you can have a serious conversation about things like implementing the four-day week or things about working time in your workplace and how you can shape and structure it better so that you're getting the most out of your staff, you're attracting the highest levels of talent, and you're delivering the best product or service for the people or for your own customers, for example. So there isn't really a strong connection between this idea of, well, you know, I spend 12 or so on hours a day at work and that as a result I'm a hugely productive employee. That's not really, it's not really based on, I suppose, the evidence doesn't really support the claim that that's where we're at. So what we've been able to prove, I suppose, time and again through trials in Ireland, in the UK and across the world, is that actually when you reduce the number of hours that people spend at work, they're as productive, if not more productive. They're happier in their workplace. They're happier in their lives. They report less stress, burnout, fatigue and so on. And the companies, and this is, and I mentioned it earlier on, I guess, the key point for us is that the companies themselves that sign up to the trial will stay with the four-day week and won't go back to the old way of working.
Absolutely. And from the UK pilot programme of over 60 companies with 3,500 workers, there was a 71% increase in well-being. They felt 39% of people felt that they were less burnt out, 57% reduction in staff turnover and 65% reduction in sick days, which is huge and I suppose a benefit for all involved. In terms of the day that isn't work day, like, is it the Friday that you take off, or is it that people just have the option to just drop a day? What way was it working, Kevin?
So this is one thing I like most about the 4-day week, is the level of, I suppose, workplace democracy involved in it. So you can have, there's no one size fits all model for the 4-day week. The 4-day week does work for everyone and it works for every sector, but there's no one model of the 4-day week that works absolutely everywhere. And you'll even see within particular companies, maybe on a team basis or a division basis, that there's a 4-day week where, you know, one team can say, well, actually, we're able to take every Friday off, or we're able to take every Monday off. And then it's different for other companies. You'll still have companies that are required to operate on a 24/7 basis, for example. So it's decided at the company, on a company by company basis. And actually, we would encourage that teams, departments, divisions and so on are involved in the conversation about, well, we need to do these things. We can't do without those things. And this is how a reduced working week, or this is how the water gets around the rock in terms of our reduced working week. So, you know, there's a load of different ways to do this. As I mentioned, there's no one size fits all model, but it does work for everyone.
OK, Kevin, before I let you go, just in terms of the companies that can get involved, is it open to anybody?
Absolutely. It's wide open to everyone. And if the information sessions are obviously a non-committal kind of experience for companies that are interested in taking a look at this, they can ask all the questions that occur to them around, you know, the challenges for their industry and so on. And they, you know, there's a quite a significant pre-trial phase in terms of the training, the support, FAQ sessions, peer mentoring and so on, that, you know, we are invested in making the 4-day week work for these companies as much as they will be investing in it themselves. So we provide a significant amount of support in that respect, and the information sessions will go through all of that, but it's absolutely open to everyone who wants to attend.
Okay, that is Kevin Donoghue, Chair of 4-Day Week Ireland. And of course, if you want to get any more information on that, you can Google 4-Day Week Ireland, and there are information sessions happening this Thursday, the 4th of May, and of course next Thursday, the 11th of May, from 1 until 2, so you can sign up there. That's all I have time for today. Just to get to one last message. Hi, Cuiva, enjoy the programme. Big fan of Bruce Springsteen's music, and it's about the positivity when you're older. That comes in from Teresa. Thanks very much, Teresa, for that one. And I hope you're going along to the concert. And if you're not, I'm sure you'll be able to listen in on YouTube or something like that. That's all we have time for today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow between 2 and 3.